And now, your local forecast.
Welcome back to the forecast. My name is M4 Sonic. I'm joined this week by my co-host Chief Street and...
got a very special guest today. We've got Lazy Rich in the house.
Welcome. Thank you.
Lazy Rich is a DJ and producer. He's from the UK, lived in Canada for a bit, and now he's in Adelaide. He's also the CTO of Label Engine.
Thank you so much. Almost right. CTO of Create Music Group.
Okay, right.
And founder of Label Engine.
There you go. That's a better way.
Scratch that. Go again.
I asked Luke before and that's what I got told. So
let's go again. Let's go again. That was good though.
No, it's more fun. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Let's go back. I want to basically start from the very beginning.
The very beginning.
Yeah. So can you remember the first memory of getting into music? Like, have you always done music?
Technotronic, Pump Up the Jam.
Yep. That's what inspired?
That was my parents were into house music.
Yeah, right.
Because being in the UK, it was everywhere.
Yep.
And so we saw Technotronic on the TV.
Yeah.
And my dad went out and he bought the album, Technotronic.
Wow.
And we just played Technotronic all the time.
Yeah.
And I used to get home from school and there's a radio show like 3:30 to 4:30 playing dance music. I used to sit there in my bedroom making Lego, listen to dance music. And that was it. That was my thing.
How old were you?
Technotronic, I was 4.
Yeah. Wow, so from 4 you were like, that's what I wanted to do.
That was just the sort of music I liked.
Yeah, nice.
I can't believe you were exposed to it that early on. Like, I was lucky. Like, I didn't hear my first dance music till I was like a teenager.
Probably. 4, I was probably still doing Mary Had a Little
There you are, clubbing. Yeah, unreal. So did you play an instrument young or?
I'm not musical.
What?
I'm not a musical person.
What do you mean?
I can't play any instruments. I dabbled a bit with guitar. I played a little bit of keyboard at school. I just could never pick it up.
Yeah, right.
You just getting my fingers to move and hit the right keys or do the strings, it just doesn't work. And that's why electronic music really grabbed me, because no one in electronic music is really musical.
That's very true. Yeah, we've spoken on this podcast before about the difference between like musicians and technicians.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So I always put the analogy of I can't draw. But Photoshop, and I can edit and redo and rearrange. Oh, I can make anything.
Yeah, right.
It's the same with Cubase or, you know, any software. Yep. I can't play the piano.
Yep.
But if I have, you know, 1,000 goes to get it right, eventually I can make something half decent.
Interesting. So from age 4, how long did it take before you were experimenting with electronic music?
In terms of, I got into DJing when I was in university.
Yep.
There was a bar in our university and there was a guy playing drum and bass and me and my friend thought, oh, we can do that.
Yep.
Can't be that hard. I was into clubbing and sorts. So went to, I guess you'd call it Radio Shack or whatever, bought some CD decks and just started messing around and just got hooked.
Amazing. What were you studying at uni?
I did computer science.
Nice. Okay.
So
music wasn't the career path. It was a passion and a hobby.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's into music, right? I wouldn't say I was just more into music than anyone else or anything like that, but the DJing, it kind of married the technical side of it and it was almost like a game.
Right.
You know, there's that skill to learn and it's addictive. And so I bought eventually bought Technics 1210s and spent all my student loan on record shop every weekend and I just practice so much known as a DJ.
So you were a real DJ?
Real.
A real, yeah. No, because
yeah,
I don't think I've ever touched vinyl in my life.
Oh, really?
Nah. No. Well, I was never meant to be a DJ.
Right.
So Launchpad was the first controller I ever used. And then it was the expectation that when you were called up for a show, you could just jump on what was, I think then was the 2000s. But no, I'd never, not even used CDs. It was always USB.
Wow. Oh, you're so lucky. You missed out. I spent so long on that skill that I never really ended up using that much. In terms of the beat matching on vinyl is so much different than beat matching on CDs.
Yeah, where's the sync button?
Exactly. There's a real, real skill to it.
Yeah.
And I poured hours and hours and hours into that just learned how to beat match, and I did DJ competitions and all sorts. That was my hobby. I spent all my money on records, and then it just kind of switched to the CDs and the USBs and whatever.
And the technology kind of made all that skill redundant in a way.
Because... A little bit, because I must admit, when it came to the gigs later on in my life, it was a sync button. You know, I knew exactly what percentage to put on the display to make it match. And so all the kind of, it took the fear out of it, but also it did take the skill out of it. You were no longer it was no longer special, you know?
You're happy that you didn't have to carry a crate around of records?
I remember not only carrying the box of records, but also the flight cases with the decks and
so
the
you
mixer.
Took the whole.
Yeah, right. I mean,
wow. I've always loved being a DJ because I bring a pair of headphones and a USB and a bottle of water, and I'm like,
in a bottle of water.
Yeah, I don't drink when I play at all, really. Yeah. So, yeah. But compare that to having two bags full of like the mixes and the records.
I used to have to get mates to help me and carry it. I mean, I had a very, very long DJ career and it was very slow getting into it. Lots of really terrible gigs at bars and student halls and everything. Just trying to build up this DJing side of things. Just terrible, terrible gigs.
What made them so terrible? Was it just the crowd wasn't into it?
It's when the highlight of your night is that someone kind of shuffled their shoulders a little bit. That was, oh, did you see that person there? Oh, they were
going
for it.
Were they all trying to hook up and socialize and you were just kind of spinning the records in the back?
Yeah, I was playing like really jazzy, soulful, funky house at bars. That was my thing because that was the best, easiest way to get gigs, right? You couldn't make it into the big clubs because you had to be a real big name, but you could probably get into the bars, you know. Some of them paid money, maybe like 50 quid for a gig or something like that. But you had to take all your gear to them and everything. It was,
wow. And how long would you play for?
Oh, it's those gigs where it goes for like 3 hours.
Yeah,
you know?
Wow.
Like you're just background music.
Yeah. Mm. Did you ever do weddings?
Never did a wedding.
That's a lot of DJs.
Also, never did the shop. Have you ever seen the DJs in the shops?
No. Oh, what, like at a...
Like a cool like clothes shop or something like that. They had a DJ.
Okay.
So unnecessary. So completely just sorry people that do that, but I mean,
I think we've got them at Culture Kings. Is it? I think they've got the decks up there and the basketball rings. And
I helped a friend organize. He owns a gym to have DJs play at the gym, and no one cared.
It's just not necessary.
No.
Yeah.
Background music.
That's background music. And that's what half my gigs were. But it was good practice and whatever. And
so how long did you do that?
That was all through university. So that would have been 4 years. Mm. And then after university, I maybe started getting to a couple of clubs back in England. Mm. I think I got offered a residency just as I decided to go to Canada. So I left Canada when I was left England when I was 21 or something, and then just moved to Canada just to
as
go.
You do.
As you do, just had a mate who was going. He said, do you want to come along? Why not?
Cool.
I was working at a record store at the time and job was going nowhere, bored. So I'll go do something else.
Did you take your decks?
I took some records.
Mm-hmm.
I sold my decks. And then within about 6 months of being in Canada, I ended up buying some decks again because I just had to do it, you know? And that's when things started taking off. I guess I was, for a short time, I could be the international DJ.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, Lazy Rich from the UK, you know? So that was my way to get in. Had a job then, so I actually had some good money to buy records. I was still doing vinyl then. Practice, DJ competitions, and then networking. So I was going out 3 times a week, meeting the promoters, talking to promoters, talking to all the DJs, demos, forums. Forums were big back then. Yeah. So I would just spam the forums with new mixes. And anytime anyone replied to my post about my mix, engage in a conversation so the thread gets more traction. Nice. And I was just really hammering that.
Yeah. So 1 year in Canada, did you notice a major difference in the music culture?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Did you find it easier because...
I found it easier. I found that maybe because I was English, I was just a bit special and it was interesting. I was the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
By that time, I was pretty good at DJing.
Yeah.
And it was just as Electra was taken off, Electra House.
Yeah, cool.
And I really got into that and I really jumped on that. Steve Angelo was just like blowing up at the time and I was hammering that stuff. Mixes were doing really well on the forums. Started to get some gigs and then met a guy called Aman Hershey. And he said, if you want to get some gigs, you've got to start making music.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Yep. And he was so right.
Yep.
So then you started transitioning into actually creating music rather than just mixing it all?
Yeah. So I met Hershey and his buddy, Jeff Daniels, who I later like shared a house with. And they said to me, go buy Cubase.
We've all been there.
Yep. And they just showed me how to use it.
Yep.
Just basics. And I just worked. So I at the time, I was working for a company called Kiwi Collection, making their website for them. So I do 8 hours there, come home, 8 hours of music production, then go out, like clubbing 3 nights a week, and then go to sleep sometimes. But that's all I did. Just work.
Wow.
Because that's what you got to do.
Yep.
You've been there, right? I mean. Oh.
Yeah. Team no sleep. Yeah, wow. Okay, so you're in Cubase. I actually started on Cubase when I was 14 years old. Cubase wow. SE. So I think that's like the limited, like the light version of Ableton, I think. But I was so overwhelmed because the keyboard I had at the time had to output MIDI to a MIDI interface, which then went to the computer and the computer was not powerful enough to process anything in real time. And I got so frustrated with it that I just canned it. I didn't understand what quantizing was or anything like that. I just wanted to play some keys. Because I come from a background of playing keys and I thought I would just record that almost like a tape recorder, but digitally. So I got very frustrated and just canned it. It was too hard. And then revisited, I think, when I got a Mac that had GarageBand and that was just such a simple interface. And then it was bang, straight into Ableton, real Ableton. Yeah.
How did you find your learning curve when it came to Cubase?
I remember the first song I made. So sit down at Cubase. I think I bought a magazine that had a CD with some samples on it.
Oh yeah.
And I think I'd like sampled some kick drums from different songs or whatever and put together this song. And I remember finishing it thinking, geez, that was easy. Done. And then a day later you go back and listen to it or in your headphones compared to other songs, and you're like, well, there's something missing there. This is appalling. You know? This is abysmal. Like what a, there's such an art to it.
Yeah.
It is so complex. Mm-hmm. And I spent years and years and never reached the mastery that others have. No, it was.
You reckon?
Yeah, I disagree. I think you're quite up
disagree,
there.
Yeah. You've mastered, absolutely.
I don't know what compression is.
All right. I'm not a very technical producer either. So
yeah.
I know you throw some plugins. Oh my God. On.
Make. Quiet things loud and making loud things quiet.
Thresholds and stuff.
But. Yeah.
Yeah. I just.
But I love that. That's great.
I don't think I ever watched a single tutorial. I just sat there and twiddled with things until it made sense.
Your two friends that introduced you to Cubase, were they like mentoring you or showing you how it was done? Or did they literally just give you the software and was like.
Really good feedback.
Yeah.
This is good. This isn't good. Hey, have you tried this? So, and because I was living with a guy, like feedback really quickly.
Nice. And honest feedback too.
Really honest feedback. So that really, really helped.
Sure does.
But I persisted and just kept doing it and it just got better and better and better. And yeah, I loved it. I was obsessed.
Yeah.
Absolutely obsessed. I spent every single minute I had doing it and I had dreams. You know, I had dreams of being big and making it. I thought, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you're mixing with the right people that supported that.
Absolutely. At the time, they'd had music on labels, right? Yeah. They'd actually had their music in Beatport. To me, getting a song on Beatport, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
yeah,
was,
yeah, yeah.
You've made it when you've got a song on Beatport. And to their credit, their music was fantastic, like absolutely fantastic. And if they're watching this, I am so much, right? These guys just made my career. So if you're watching, thank you, you know? But yeah, loved it. Absolutely loved it and kept doing it. And eventually the music got better. And I think I sent stuff to labels way too soon.
Yeah, you would have rather wait?
I just had this real desire. I've got to get on Beatport. I've got to get on Beatport.
Yeah.
And the music was crap, right? It just wasn't up to standard, but I sent off anyway. And if you go digging on Beatport now and you go through to the 45th page of Beatport for me, you'll see all my old tracks and you'll be like, yeah.
We'll put a link in the description.
Do not Spotify.
Do not digging later.
Yeah.
Do not assault your ears with the dross that I've made. I wouldn't say I'm embarrassed because it's part of the journey. But it wasn't up to standard. It wasn't professional, but it was a really good learning process. And so if I was to do it differently today, I'd probably switch my name and done that and, you know, tried it with a different alias just to get stuff out there.
Sure.
But hindsight is a powerful thing, right?
Yeah.
What was really good though was just chucking stuff on Beatport and just seeing what hit. Back in the early days, I was trying all sorts. It was really out there, some of the stuff I was making. It wasn't, you know, stuff that would necessarily work in clubs. Was it progressive house or electro house or regular house? I just wasn't sure. Yeah. But then you just keep throwing darts at a dartboard and eventually something hits. And I eventually put out a track. Amazing to get a track signed. Like, it's just incredible. That feeling that, you know, a label actually says, we think this is good enough. It's such a buzz, right? And finally had a track and it got in the charts. The Beatport charts.
Yeah.
It got to like number 45 on the Beatport Electro House chart. And that for me was a big step. Really,
that
big
kind of validation is so motivating, is, right? Especially when you know that it's based on quality, which is something that is changing in the new landscape. And we'll get into that later. But okay, so have you collaborated with anybody at this point? Or are you just doing solo records?
What really worked for me was remixes.
Yep.
I learned later in my life, I'm not actually very creative. I'm not musical. I'm not creative.
What are you? Coder.
I'm a coder. I'm such a logical thinker to the max.
Mm-hmm.
I think way too much. And so if I was given these bricks, you know, the building pieces to make a song, which you get when, if you're going to remix someone else's track, they give you the vocals, they give you some drum loops, they give you some samples, whatever. And I knew I could rearrange that and make something that I thought was better than it started with. You know, I could put my own spin on it because I didn't have to worry about the annoying stuff like making good quality samples, because that's hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
I didn't have to spend hours and hours fiddling with drum loops. Obviously sample libraries were huge to me. You can hear it in my music. There's so many samples.
Right.
Vengeance samples, right? That's good old Vengeance.
Yeah, every, the one shot, the basses, that type of stuff. Yeah.
My music is just a catalogue of Vengeance samples, right? But having that, it just, they're tools that just save you time.
Yeah.
And you can experiment.
We're very pro
and you can,
sampling.
And exactly, yeah. And you can make something that's really good.
Yep.
And it eventually got to the point where I was pretty proud of some of the stuff.
Awesome.
I still look back at it now and sometimes I think, what on earth was I thinking? You know, why is the clap the loudest clap that's ever existed in the world, right? Why is the riser louder than the synth? Yeah. You know, why is it distorted? How on earth did I sit there and think this was good enough?
Yeah.
But
now we're all with it. So, okay, that leads me to my next question. At this point in time, are you doing the final mix, final master? Is this all done by you or are you palming it off to someone else? Did the record label at any point step in and say, actually, no, we use this guy to finish the record?
I think in my whole career, I didn't master two tracks.
Right.
Everything else I mastered. I did the whole thing myself.
Yep.
Yep.
And from a technical standpoint, did you enjoy that process?
Horrendous. Awful. The hours of my life that I've wasted turning these knobs, doing nothing.
Well, I didn't know what just compression making, was.
Just making it worse.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, I hate
months.
It when that happens when you overcook
and,
it.
And your ears are hurting.
Yeah.
You've got it so loud because you're trying to figure out why doesn't it sound as good as TJR's track or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm. Did you a lot of A-B referencing?
Absolutely.
Oh, you know. Sorry, comparison's the thief of joy when it comes to that. That's, you can look at the spectrum of sound and go, oh yeah, it's not, the bass isn't right, it's not hitting, but anything else, that it's just soul destroying, isn't it? Like,
I just didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was twiddling knobs and tweaking things around.
Yep.
I had no theory to back it up on. I was just twiddling stuff and just waiting for it to work. And sometimes it did and sometimes it didn't. Mm-hmm. There are tracks that I've done that I think they sound really good. Yeah. You know, they sound professional, but a lot that really doesn't, you know?
Interesting. Well, I mean, it's very subjective. I know there's benchmarks for loudness and understanding the basics of mixing and stuff like that, which took me the longest time to figure out because I was slap and dash. Mm. I was very much about, I really can't be bothered working on the percussion. I just want to do the keys and build the chords and then get some vocals and whatever, and the track will work itself out as opposed to sitting there and finessing. But eventually at some point in time, it starts, it's like language. It makes sense. You can just quickly identify this guy next to me on the couch, Chief, I master his music and I have to do almost nothing to it. I don't know how he gets it so balanced considering he does most of his work not from the studio here. You do it at home. And then you bring me a track and everything is just perfectly balanced. And that's like from an objective standpoint too. That's not just me enjoying your music. When I look at it sonically as well as audibly, I can just tell it works. So some people get it. And then 99% of the rest of my clients that send me music to help in terms of EDM stuff, whoa, you're right. It's like, why is the clap 6 dB louder than anything else on this track? It's, yeah.
See, one of the reasons I never got my stuff mastered is because I produced with my entire mastering chain on the whole time. I'm not lying.
Yeah, that's smart though. It's madness. For it. Hey,
my computer, I bought the most powerful computer I could because I needed to, because I had this entire chain on the whole
time. So you could master in real time.
So mastering in real time. So you know exactly what it's going to sound like.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't think anyone does, right? That's just.
Well, I've gone back to analog. Okay. So running through an analog compressor and there is a delay from the time you hit space to the time that it goes and then comes back. So can't do that now.
Yeah. It just goes to say there's no real right way to do it though. So if you want to put a master on, you can.
Yeah. And I'm not professing to being like really good at it either. I think I know what sounds good and what doesn't. And you're right. It's just tweaking until it's like, yeah, that's getting there. But I've compared to so many other tracks that have been mastered well and you start to see a pattern. And so I look visually now at the spectrum of sound and go, wow, always about this point here that the if it's in this key, that's where the kick's meant to look like. That's, you know, so it's like a photo. So that's how I do it, referencing visually more than sonically. And then I listen back and go, no, actually it needs a bit more here. But yeah, I've got like a benchmark now, but I didn't have that for like 10 years because I was just slap and dash. But yeah. So let's keep going. So you're doing the mixing and the mastering of your records. Labels are now accepting and you're in the charts. Was there a big show that came about or a big event or something that came from that that then spurred on the next chapter?
So a few things happened. Let me see. I got a manager.
Oh, big move.
I got a manager.
Move. Yep.
So one track, before that, I'd actually started my own label.
Yeah. Okay. Which, wait, which what?
It was all a bit of a blur, but things, I just kept putting out more tracks and more tracks and they kept getting the charts and it was good, you know? And I was developing this sound. People said that they can always tell when it's one of my tracks, probably because it's always really badly mastered, right? No. It's always the one with the snare that's too loud. Yeah. But people knew my tracks and I was developing a style.
Yeah.
And I think it was catching on. I like to think it was at the forefront of electro house and I was quite experimental.
Absolutely.
People might just think I made lots of stupid mistakes, but anyway, it was getting popular.
No, not at all. You were a pioneer.
Yeah, there was a movement at that time.
Yeah.
Possibly. Possibly.
So humble. Take note, people watching at home. Like, wow.
I do actually remember did a remix for Plasma Pool Records for some, can't remember the name of the track, Beat Pushes or something like that. And I remember thinking, wouldn't it be cool if instead of using the same bass line all the way throughout, I switched it up and had a real like call and response, this bass line and then a different bass line. And there was another remix I did for Cherouz as well, where call and response, two different things.
Cool.
And that, it did well. And you didn't hear much of that, you know?
So you went chasing a trend or a hashtag or following another famous artist, you were just doing you, right?
Then I was at that point. At that point when I started the Complexstro type thing, mm-hmm. just adding in more synths and making it more complex. It was interesting, you know?
And who else was doing that type of music?
I mean, the big guy at the time was Wolfgang Gartner, obviously.
Yeah.
He was just, oh man, what a producer.
Incredible. I still to this day can't think of producers that are, I mean, I'm probably out of touch, but when I listen back to that style of Complexity, it's like, wow. At what point did you step back from the track and then go, you know what, let's add some more? You know, just incredible.
Just insanity.
Yeah.
The skill of that guy is just nuts. Absolutely nuts. There are plenty of other great producers in the space. Dirty Loud and Felga, I wouldn't say so much Complexity, but that the Brazilian electro was pretty big. Let's get back on track. I guess more with a career mind of things. I did actually start a label with Hershey and Jeff Daniels,
right?
Called Stereo Soul, and we put out some tracks. We got to go to Miami and push our music around and do all that, which is great fun. And that kind of that label stalled a bit, and so I decided to do something myself called Big Fish Recordings. I started off that label, and it doesn't mean anything to start a label. You just say, hey, I'm called Big Fish Recordings now. We're going to start putting some music out.
Yep.
So I put out my own tracks. I had the networking was a huge thing, right? We're all Skype back then and MSN Messenger.
Oh,
and you talk to all the producers and just like when you hear a track, you're like, hey, I can sign your track.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think how did I started getting distributed through Plasma Pool first of all. And then I started reaching out to the stores directly. So I reached out to Beatport and said, can I distribute my music direct with you? And they said, sure. And who else was it? Track It Down and Juno and DJ Download.
Yeah.
Just started distributing through them myself.
Wow, directly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an enormous task.
Yeah, I guess organizationally, I was pretty good. It wasn't that tricky.
Okay.
They knew who I was because I'd been on in the charts. They knew I was a half-decent producer, so they thought my label would do all right.
Mm-hmm.
So they allowed me to submit direct to them. Usually when you start a label with Stereo Soul, we went through a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And so back then, distributors, what they did was they gave you, you basically had to fill in a spreadsheet with all your music. You had to send them the audio files. They then submit it to the stores and they take 30% of your earnings and send you back a spreadsheet with how much you earn. And how much each track earned. And that's just how distribution works.
Right.
Remember that because it's important when we start talking about labeling in a bit. Where should we go from here? Because the label started taking off. Had some, I was remixed on the label, had some good artists released on the label. One of my remixes hit number one on Track It Down and got noticed by my manager at the time. It wasn't a big track. Track It Down was a smaller store. And he just came over to my apartment and said, you want me to manage you? And at the time, I think the biggest gig I'd had was $500.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, if you can get me $1,000 a gig, then I can do this full time.
Yeah,
quit my job and do it. And he said, sure. So I did. And so I quit my day job and just said, I'm just going to sit at home all day, make music, see how it goes.
Living the dream.
It was good. It was a good time. The first year, I probably just about covered my expenses.
Mm-hmm.
But then it did start to ramp up.
Yeah.
When you think about these DJs that have, you know, they've made it and you think about their gigs, you think that they're playing sold out festivals and these massive arenas and whatever. Oh, the quality of gigs I had was abysmal.
Right.
Absolutely abysmal.
Yeah.
I always said, you can tell how good your gig is going to be by the car that turns up to pick you up.
Oh, no.
So,
horse and cart sounds like.
So, you know that if it's the beaten up Camry, you know it's going to be the hippie festival.
Yep.
You know that if it's the limo, it's going to be the VIP club where no one cares about the music.
Interesting. Right? Which one would you prefer?
I was playing to people that actually dance. That's what gets you going, right?
100%.
When you DJ, you don't care about anything as long as people are having a good time.
Yeah, that's right.
You want people to be facing forward so you can interact with them, so you can read them, so you know what to play.
Yep.
I always DJed. Like, I didn't prepare sets. I always DJed.
Real DJ.
actual thinking, what track should I play next?
Yeah.
Always did that. But those gigs were that's why you did it. I never got scared about my gigs. Like I never got stage fright or never, you know, worried about being up on stage, even though I'm a pretty reserved and quiet guy. But I was worried about, is my gig going to be busy? Am I going to look like an idiot DJing to 5 people? Because that is the worst. And you always got to do it. You've always got to play, no matter if I have literally played to empty rooms where there was not a single person.
I've got shocker stories about that. Oh, yeah. It's humbling and it's character building.
Yeah.
I actually got asked by a promoter once. I landed in Sydney and it was about an hour's drive in a similar situation. The car that pulled up, I was like, okay. And he drives me, and I won't mention where it is, but he drives me up to Newcastle to this venue, which was effectively a pub, and just started negging me as soon as we rocked up. Oh, not many people lined up. Oh, did you promote this much on social media? Oh, all right. And then we get in there and we go to the basement area. No one. And the residents are just cooked out of their minds playing Pokemon theme song on repeat. So they've cleared the room. There's no one there. Everybody's gone upstairs to the actual pub. It's like, well, there's no one here. Can you play upstairs? At this point in time, I'm not actually like a versatile DJ. I'm still on my launch pad with a laptop playing electro house and dubstep and whatever. I'm like, I can give it a go. So I start playing upstairs to old mate who's just finished, you know, in the pokey room, that's come out to have a pub meal and eat his dinner and whatever. And I'm playing hard music bangers. Like Melbourne Bounce was really popular back then. Anyway, promoter comes back up. He's like, mate, can you just dial it down a little bit? And some of the girls want you to play Kesha. I'm like, I'm not your guy. And he's like, no worries, mate. Let's wrap it up. I'll get the residents back on and I'll take you back to Sydney. So we get in the car. We're driving home. He's like, so any chance we can get a refund?
Old.
It was the quietest drive home. I remember just sitting there thinking, what do I do in this situation? Like, no?
Yeah,
no. But yeah, we've all been there. Humbling.
Wow.
There you go.
I'm shocked. That is an experience and a half.
I haven't told
I've
that story.
I've never been asked for a refund.
I got asked for a refund. I don't even feel it was my fault. Like, I rocked up to do the job I was meant to do. And yeah, but this is the thing. And it was a steep learning curve. I had imposter syndrome massively because I was not a DJ. And in fact, I'd probably lost a bit of support from my hometown here in Adelaide because I hadn't done the whole residential thing and, you know, earned my stripes and gone up the ranks before then having an opportunity. It was just blew up on YouTube, all of a sudden taking main stage slots and people going, who is this guy and why? And so rigid in, I can only play what I've prepared in Ableton on my controller. So yeah, there were times where venues weren't at capacity and you needed to tone it down and I couldn't. So I just owned it, just went for it. Hit and miss. I've learned since. Now I'm a DJ. I can play to a crowd.
Yeah, flexibility is a really strong thing.
Yeah.
I played such a wide range of gigs. The VIP clubs were always the toughest, you know.
Yeah. Where you get a lot of requests.
You get a lot and I could never do the requests, but you kind of try and play. I could never bring myself to play music I didn't like.
Sure.
I had to like the song.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's a remix of a popular vocal, that's always the go, right? Every big pop song that comes out, there was like the Rehab remix or something like that. And you can play that.
Thank God though, because nowadays when you have to play Justin Bieber, Ed Sheeran, you're like, oh.
Yeah. So you've got your VIP club folder.
Nice.
And you're going through that. And sometimes these gigs go on and on and you're like, I'm out of songs. You know, I've played the same song twice. I've
never done that.
Oh, okay.
I've never played the same song twice.
Okay. I'm not a real DJ.
I am now. I'll do it next time.
I have played the same song twice immediately after the last song. That's good.
Wow. That's was that by a request or was that
no,
just...
No, that was by drunkenness.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wrong cue.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
one was the same one. It's still loaded up.
And okay, at this stage, are you still on vinyl or have you gone across to digital now?
It was CDs.
Yeah. CDs. Okay. So you've CDs got the CD time. Sleeves.
Yeah.
And you're rocking up with a big folder.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's a ton of preparation, right?
Yep. Burning all those CDs and downloading from Beatport.
Yep.
Trying to get across the border into the States. with your big folder and your headphones saying, oh, I'm just going for a mate's wedding. yeah, that was always fun. Oh, that was the most nerve-wracking thing.
Yeah.
Going down to the States.
Interesting. DJing. Even just from up across the border. I mean, it's a big deal when you've done a 14-hour flight. I rocked up with a flight case full of launch pads. And same thing, customs officers. Why are you bringing gear in? And I, at this point, I'm on holiday on the ESTA visa. Like, oh, just going to a showcase event and wanted to bring this equipment. And all right, you need to come answer more questions. Wrong thing to say. Like, yeah, it's nerve-wracking, hey?
Yeah, I attended so many weddings. So many weddings. Yeah.
Same.
I was just so popular for the weddings. Yeah.
Then I got my visa.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
You had a lot of remixes as well, but I noticed in your catalog there's a lot of collaborations as well. Can you talk about how they kind of came about? I know there's a couple of notable ones, the one with Porter Robinson, Chris Lake. Their story behind those?
Because collaborations are easier than originals.
The same note of the remix, yeah.
You get the inspiration. You get someone to work with. You get parts. You can play around with it and you can get that immediate feedback. And I just found that my productions were better when I worked with someone else.
So was your collaboration then second to the project, not first? Were you giving a project to other collaborators or were you receiving?
Changed both ways.
Okay.
In some cases, you start with an idea and send it back. My favorite ever collaboration was with Hot Mouth, John Pignato, a track called Flash, which is probably one of my biggest tracks. And that really was just a back and forward for a good 6 months.
Yeah, wow.
Back and forward in this track. And I think that is the track I am proud of most.
Yeah, cool. You know, we'll put a link to that one.
Mastering on that one.
You did that?
I nailed that one. Yeah, I'm really, nice. Everything in that track, I'm just like super proud of, you know. Other tracks, the one with Porter Robinson, I'm going to come clean. He did most of it by a long way.
Yeah. We've all been in that situation where, if it sounds awesome, you're just like, we're going with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No need to send it back. Like, it's done.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's just mainly organization and prep and align the vocalist and some touching up and some mastering.
Still a team effort at the end of the day. Yeah. You know? Wouldn't have come about had the collaboration not started.
The hardest thing with collaborations is the discussion around whose name is going first.
Oh, yeah. Is it just, how does it go?
It's a free-for-all. It's never discussed at the start. Unfortunately, it just doesn't
when the
happen.
The managers come in at the end, right?
And then the managers come in. It's like,
a label. Label's like, well, it's our boy. It's going on our label. Yeah. So it's his name first.
So typically, it would be either the person that did the most work.
Right.
Or the person who is biggest and most prominent.
Mm.
You know, so the Porter Robinson one, he was big at the time of me. So he went first.
Right.
The Chris Lake one, he went first.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It wasn't until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, or maybe more recent, that Spotify, I think when you uploaded it was whoever's name was first, that's how it would appear. I think nowadays it doesn't matter as much. I think it can switch. Is that correct?
You can define the order when you upload it.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's been a while since I've heard much to do with the label, Luke. Sorry. But yeah, that I've always been pretty relaxed about it. Unless when I was signed with Ultra, it was sort of like, no, I've come to you with this opportunity to be on Ultra. My name first. But yeah, sometimes an awkward conversation.
Really, really awkward conversations. Yeah. Managers involved, managers shouting at each other. Really nasty, horrible conversations.
Which is bizarre, right? Because like…
Yeah, just a name and an artist name. Did it matter to you at all or…
To be honest, it did. You know, I wanted… If your name's first, people say, oh, well, it's the Lazy Rich track.
That's fair. It's a very valid call.
Yeah.
Those collaborations, were you… Mostly all done online. Did you ever get in a studio with people or?
Yeah, I did on a couple of occasions. I never really got much out of working in a studio with people. Mm. I just found I did better when they would send over the stuff and I could just focus on it for a few days and play around with it. So having the pressure of you're in the studio now and you've got to do something. I actually had a pretty big producer fly me out to Miami or wherever it was to go in a studio with him and sit there. I just couldn't do anything. You know, if you don't have that inspiration right there, what can you do?
But also if your workflow is very different, so if it's more of technical aspects and piecing things together, the last thing you want is someone breathing down your shoulder while you're trying to work stuff out.
Come up with something now.
In a completely different environment. Yeah. You're not used to.
Way to kill creativity. That's not inspirational. That's just pressure.
Yeah. So nothing came of that.
Fair enough. Yeah, we often talk about like the studio here and how best to use other people as a resource and to get motivated and whatever. But again, it definitely comes down to the technicians. I used to do studio sessions with people where you could tell that they were uncomfortable and would have it cranked. It was so loud in there because they were working on the kick drum. And if the kick sounded great, fantastic. But my opinion was, I don't need to be in here while you're doing this. Let's just go our separate ways and then come back in the end. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank goodness for Skype, right?
I don't think I've ever used Skype to collaborate.
You're so young.
Probably Discord now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Discord? What? No. Just text.
Emails.
Yeah. Gmails, yeah, Skype. No, I don't, the internet connection at the studio is not good enough to actually hold video. So, yeah, I did one recently where I had to, it was like a Google Hangout or something. I can't remember, but they were streaming it to Twitch. And right before we went live, the technician's like, do you have a better Wi-Fi connection? Because of all the videos, yours is 8-bit pixelated. I'm like, yeah, sorry, Aussie internet. Yeah. Okay, so at this point in your career, things are popping off, obviously. You've got some pretty awesome tracks, collaborations with big artists. Are you playing festivals and stuff yet? Like,
yeah. International gigs. The first international gig, I had a couple of random festivals in the States, nothing too crazy. Maybe a couple of thousand people. Quite like, I'm not going to say hippie festivals, but EDM ravers.
Yeah,
no. Nice. Ravers, right.
Are they called, what are the ones that wear the fluffy boots?
Exactly.
Those ones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had one really interesting gig in Brazil. This guy called Marcio Groove. Super nice guy.
Big name too.
He's awesome, right? He called me up and he said, oh, you know, I think you could be big in Brazil. Why don't you come down to Brazil? I don't have much money. I'm like, go to Brazil. Be awesome. So I get there. Just fly down to Brazil. I have to get my 7 injections first for all the yellow fever and whatever. Yeah. So just get on a flight, go to Brazil. Guy picks me up from the airport, get in the car. He's got his can of beer open in the car. I think this is going to be a real experience, isn't it? You know? Says, I didn't think it was right. You know, you've been in a hotel on your own. So I've got you and my family. So I went and stayed with his family. So his mother, his father, I think a sister and a brother in their like little basement room.
What point did you feel scared?
I wasn't scared, but it was odd.
Yeah.
I think I had a minor panic attack saying, and I did say to him, I think I should probably go home. But I stuck it out.
Yeah.
And stayed with his family.
Well done. Well played.
And it was a great experience.
Yeah.
It was so different. You know, I had like his mother home cooking for me. No English.
Doing the washing for you.
Everything. Right? First time I ever saw a cockroach.
How would you go with this?
Oh, I would have to turn the car around and leave. I don't. If someone was like, "We're going to stay at my house," I'd be like, "I'm not." So
it was just in Sao Paulo, and it's Sao Paulo is an incredible place.
Yeah,
but probably not the sort of place you just go out on your own. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
As a tourist that doesn't speak language, and so, but he took me around. The gigs were. It was decent enough.
Yeah.
They were fun.
Oh, so you stayed for a while then?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Two weeks at his house.
Real authentic with his family. Brazilian.
Real authentic. You know, I played chess with his dad.
Gold.
Wow. Are you still in touch on Skype?
I haven't talked to him in years. Really great guy. Really,
that's incredible.
Really genuine.
Yeah.
But really just genuine. He just wanted to help.
Yeah.
And I remember going to his house and he was like, oh, we should make a track together.
Mm.
And this computer of his, oh man, it was like the
the cockroach.
You know those white PC speakers?
Yeah.
No, that's what he was producing
on. The volume knob on them.
And they crackle when you turn the volume up.
Exactly. He was producing on his music, considering he was producing on that, incredible. But it was like really tiny little screen and everything, and that's what he had. You know,
is this track on Beatport? Can we hear?
He's got loads of tracks on Beatport. Yeah, he
need to hear.
He was reasonably successful. He's a good producer.
Yeah. But on hopefully they're vintage and they're from these speakers.
Yeah,
I want to know. Yeah. Mix and mastering on those.
I remember we drove to a festival right in the middle of nowhere, and I met a guy called Alex Mind, who's an absolutely amazing Brazilian complexo producer. Absolutely amazing. Met him there. Had an amazing time at the festival, and I remember driving home, and I've got this fear of running out of petrol and just being stranded in the middle of nowhere. And so we're driving home and I'm watching the gauge just trickle down and down and down. And it gets to zero. I'm like, well, what's going on here? Are we going to stop? No, man, it's fine, it's fine. We just keep going on. And then they're literally, it's on zero and they're driving past petrol stations. Yeah, it's fine, it's fine. And then literally, you know, the car conks out and rolls silently into the petrol station.
No.
Seriously.
Wow.
Because they're just so laid back.
More laid back than Aussies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I freak out when I start the car and it's got the warning light. I freak out.
I'm thankful it's all digital now and it tells me how many Ks I've got left.
I hate it though when the car says 40K range. No worries. Get on the highway. Zero. Like, wait, what? okay, so you survived that trip. It sounds actually pretty amazing.
Incredible.
Did
really?
You go back?
I did go back to Brazil quite a few times, but not with Marcio.
No.
I went back with my manager sorted out through an agency and it was a bit...
Did it legit?
Do you know what? There were such weird gigs. They were festivals to 14,000-15,000 people. Mm. So the biggest crowd I ever played to was there.
Yep.
But no one dances.
What do you mean? What?
Everyone, it's like playing to a crowd of zombies where everyone is just standing watching. And it's so bizarre.
Because I would have thought a Brazilian crowd would be very lively.
Yeah.
Like you see, I know, to relate it to sports with their soccer and stuff, it's...
And it wasn't just me. Obviously, I thought...
Did you just bomb?
I thought, well, what am I doing wrong here?
Yeah.
But every act that was there, they weren't dancing until... what was their name? There's this one EDM group, Electro something. They did a Tetris remix. Do you remember that song? It was like a
Tetris song.
EDM Tetris remix.
We know the Dr. P remix, which is...
Yeah. And they played the song and it's like... The crowd just erupted. People are just going nuts just for this one song. And then they stop playing the song and the crowd's back to normal.
That's bizarre.
And the only other Felguk play there.
Yeah.
And Felguk are just so famous in Brazil.
Yeah.
They're just next level. And when Felguk are playing, everyone goes nuts.
Right.
But if it's anyone apart from that, the crowd just doesn't want to know. You know? So strange.
Must have been tough to be up there being like, I'm trying my best and no one's moving. You know, you would have exhausted all the options. It's like, maybe it's not me.
It's every single DJ, you know.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Wow.
Maybe it's the drugs. Maybe it was the water. Just.
I love how someone played the right track, the Tetris, and then boom, like ignited the crowd.
Yeah, that's
when
stopped. You play this track twice. Three times even. Like, wow. All right. So, yeah. How long until you make it over to Australia?
So I did. I got booked. I think I did three tours. Oh my God, I can't remember the guy's name. Terrible. In Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
One of the DJs there was called Vengeance. A guy called Mark Dyfer, maybe? Super nice guy. And there's a guy called Sasha, who was the manager there. And they had brought Porter Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously I was connected with Porter Robinson, so they thought they'd bring me next.
Yeah, cool.
Real wide variety of gigs. I played in Sydney. I played in, is it King's Cross?
Yeah.
Played there. Played in Brisbane with Will Bailey. That was terrible. Cairo and Bomber. So Tom, who went on to be Golden Features.
Ah.
Yeah, such a nice guy, right? So I played with those two. They actually signed a track to Big Fish and I played a few gigs with them, super good mates with them. We played a gig, that was awesome. Played in Adelaide, at HQ.
Oh, yeah, that was my first gig. Yeah.
It was 40 degrees.
Oh,
and
welcome.
There were a few like really hardcore bros at the front.
Just a few.
Wow.
And
they were actually really good big fans and they were like asking for songs and whatever. So that was really cool. But everyone else was just somewhere else in the club because it was too hot. So that kind of sucked.
Yeah, it was a big tin shed, wasn't it?
Great venue.
I missed that venue. That was my first gig.
I was under there many times.
Yeah.
Missed that.
When that venue shut down, I feel like that was the start of the domino effect. I mean, I don't know if you've heard recently how many other venues have shut. Just in recent times, but not great times valet, but in some way the refresh could be quite exciting.
I think it's everywhere. I don't think it's just Adelaide.
That's good to know.
Times are changing.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
You were touring through Australia. Did you ever think it was a place that you maybe wanted to live?
Yeah.
Well, my girlfriend at the time was Australian. So yes, I always enjoyed my time here. I really enjoyed the people here, especially. Really got on with everyone I met. I actually stayed with my girlfriend's parents when I played my gig at HQ and stuff. So,
played chess.
Any cockroaches?
No cockroaches, yeah. Thankfully. But yeah, Australia was great.
Yeah.
Jet lag was a bit tough. Mm. But, I wouldn't say any of the gigs in Australia were ever fantastic.
Interesting.
I never had, one of my defining gigs here or anything. Everything was decent. It was good. A couple of bad ones, but.
Where would you say you did have a defining gig?
Japan and Korea were just unbelievable. Yeah. Just amazing. And looking back, I don't think it was because of me. I think it's just that's how people were in clubs.
You are so honest and I admire it so much because you're spot on. I played a show quite early in my career. Career. Quite early on in my career, I played in South Korea. Am I making sense? Yes. Losing my mind. And it was a Halloween party to 4,000 people in this venue. And I had to wear a mask. And I made a massive mistake, but I learned how valuable the crowd's reaction was. So basically, my launch pad would have cues for parts of songs, not just entire tracks. And what was happening is I was building one track and going to drop the second by pressing a button straight on the, never again, by the way, don't ever DJ like this, but it would build and then I would launch the drop of this song. I missed the button because my mask, I couldn't see what I was doing. And so the music, it went do, 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 nothing. And I just went, oh no, and put my hands up. I'm wearing a mask though, so they couldn't see the devastation and the fear in my face. But everyone in the crowd went, hooray. And then I went quickly, bang, and it started. And it was like, oh my God,
it worked.
Saved. And everyone lost their mind. But I also noticed that if I ever put an arm up or did a gesture to the crowd, they would respond. And the same in Japan. I don't know why, but they just seem to they fixate on you and they follow your lead. And it's so motivating because you want to have more fun for them.
Yeah.
And they follow your lead. Not as much here in Australia.
That's exactly it. It's the crowd. And you're totally right. You play in Japan or Korea. I don't know if it's the same nowadays, but at the time, I'm going to sound old now. If you get that feedback from the crowd, it motivates you.
Massively.
And I would say my best performances were there because I was just hammering it and people loving it.
When you're in that sweet spot, that flow state where you feel like you're really getting the right result for your audience and they're loving it, those gigs go too quickly, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the way you DJ as well, picking song by song, you were really feeling it and into it, not being like, oh, they love this, but I know the next five tracks that I'm going to play. So there's not really that connection and emotion in each song you're playing.
The thought of doing anything else in front of thousands of people, couldn't do it, right? I get nervous in meetings when I've got 10 people there, right? But being up on that stage and knowing that you're really good at this and that they are really enjoying it, it is the best feeling in the world. There is nothing better.
I feel like all those hours you put in early on your career before you were a producer and that's paying off in that moment where you can feel so comfortable there. Because I mean, I know for me, maybe you, Nick, as well, where we have gone kind of opposite producers first into DJ world, and it's like almost intimidating sometimes or a bit scary getting up on stage because I feel really comfortable in that room. There's a difference when I'm playing in front of a crowd, whereas for you, I guess you're completely used to that.
You're just so confident, you know? I'm not generally a particularly confident person. But when you, I guess, all the work that you've done up to that point, you have that confidence right then and there. It's such a buzz, you know?
Validation is a massive one. And we're not talking about ego here. We're just talking about what Alex said, you summarized it so well. We do so much behind closed doors, which is our comfortable space, right? when you finally get the opportunity, and it is such a privilege to play to an audience, and you see the crowd light up, it's just part of the human experience that very few get to be a part of. And it's just, there's nothing like it. On the flip side, post-pandemic, having not played a show yet, I miss it. It's like a drug. I was addicted. You always want the next show to be bigger than the last one. You just want to get that fix. And I haven't had it in the longest time. And it actually did play a small role in reevaluating my values and who I am as a person and self-worth and things like that, because I wasn't in the limelight. And even on the internet, and again, I'm still not talking about ego. It's just being able to have the two-way engagement with an audience. It's a wonderful thing. And now I post a status and it's like crickets, and you put out a song, and unless you promote it in a certain way or you have considerable backing, and we'll get to this later, it's very hard to have the same effect. Yeah. Times have changed.
Times have changed.
Yeah.
Yep. It's, we'll probably get to this later or if we have time, whatever, but going from that DJ career where you have that feedback and it's going well and people are, you know, I've had gigs where people after the gig are cheering my name.
Incredible. Right? Yeah. How good.
How good is that?
Yeah.
Right?
I know.
And then you go from that to a more sedate career.
Yeah.
You know, or you deal with the challenges of fatherhood.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a very different,
isn't it?
Different experience, right? Very different experience.
It's a different team, no sleep, but it's nowhere near as fun. It is so challenging.
It's a different kind of fun.
Yeah, it's a great fun, trust me, but it's a very different, very different fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So to go back on your career a bit, you know, you've toured, you're producing. You've done the record label and now Label Engine. How did you come up with that? What was your motivation behind it?
Yeah. So like I said, you used to send off your stuff to the distributor. They take 30%, send you back the spreadsheet. And so I would take the spreadsheet, open up in Excel and figure out how much I needed to pay each person that had released on my label, each artist. And I just, you know, use Excel formulas, and this sheet kept getting bigger and bigger. I thought, screw this. Now it's code, might as well make something. I made something. I was getting lots of promos from, I don't know if you remember Fat Drop.
Yeah.
Getting loads of those, and I thought, I'm not paying 40, 50 quid a month to do this. I'll make my own. So I did that. And I put the two together and I said, a friend actually suggested the name, call out to Soulfix. Thank you. And suggested to call it Label Engine.
Right, name.
And put it together.
Yeah.
And I did. And I had so many contacts from the record label, from production, whatever. I just went to every label I knew and said, here, it's free. Use it. Pay me later. Right? I kept a tally of how much they were using it. Just pay me later. And some used it, some didn't. But I just got so much feedback. And I just kept improving this thing. And I was doing gigs at the same time. Like I would be in an airport in between flights, coding away and fixing bugs, and in my hotel room in Brazil, making the payment page and all sorts, you know? Because you have a lot of downtime as a DJ. There's lots of time where you just sat there waiting for the gig or whatever. Coded away.
So you got to use skills that you developed from uni.
Exactly.
How good. And you're offering a solution. You were streamlining a massive...
It was so good because I used it. It was for me.
Great.
Right. And that's the best kind of product.
Yeah.
Right. I look at this Apple Vision Pro thing that came out.
What do you think?
What problem is it solving?
None.
It's solving the problem that someone who is in Times Square can't compute with lots of screens at the same time. That's the only thing it solves.
Yeah.
You know?
Get there. Stepping stone.
Are you a fan?
I'm not a fan as in I think anyone should buy it because it's too expensive. The point of entry is too high. But it's just a step forward in the technology. And I think there will be a point. I don't know. I don't want to get into it too much, but you can hook it up to your laptop. And I think that's where you're getting the most functionality out of it. And I think it will grow from that.
So. You can hook it up to your laptop and you can put on the glasses and you can see your laptop. And that's it. That's it.
But I can see it. It's in 3D now.
It'll get there. Don't worry. Give it time.
Yeah.
It's going to take time.
Do you know Justine?
YouTuber.
She reviews all the Apple products. Yeah. I just watched a TikTok of her doing jiu-jitsu with Apple Vision Pro on.
Yeah, interesting choice.
She had it on or you had it on?
She had it on while, so, you know, doing this and that while wrestling and as you do. Good for you. Yeah. Don't know what the point of the video was. I think it was to showcase that you can do it. But
like, so solving the problem that doesn't exist. Anyway.
Spot on.
I solved a problem that does exist.
Nice.
And that's why it works. Yeah. Although it's not going to make as much money as the Apple Pro headset. But anyway. I made this thing. I found a business partner to help me with it. He decided to do distribution. Yep. So we started doing distribution and it just took off.
Well, thank you, by the way, from the music industry, because like, awesome. And it did solve and still is solving massive. Yeah.
There are so many labels to this date. They don't like paying people, right?
I wonder why.
There's no real reason for them to want to pay people.
Yeah.
And having the difficulty of accounting in the way doesn't help.
No.
And so if you can provide these labels with a really easy, straightforward way to do accounting, which is very difficult to do accounting in some of these cases, at least then you remove the roadblocks and you can convince some of them to pay their artists, which is the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
Because I was sick of not getting paid. Yeah. Really sick of it. And I bet there's so many people watching this podcast that go chase up your label right now.
Yeah.
And say, I need a statement every 90 days because that's what you promised me.
And artists, I think, yeah, that's sort of become the role of the manager. And if you're not with a manager or represented by someone, it's just, oh, I'll get to it later. And yeah, you should have the staff.
In a state of thinking it's going to be delivered one day. Mm. And then in the background,
they're not going to pay you.
No.
I didn't realize that in Label Engine, it's not only helping the label, but it's helping the artist too. And I knew that obviously because Luke's all over it and that I knew it was making his life easier. But I didn't realize as someone who puts records on their label that, you know, it facilitates that payment cycle being held accountable to. So
yeah, it's huge.
And what we did was change the game where I talked about, what was the name of that distributor? Whatever, where you just send the music to them and they send it back. We as a distributor did something. We're there to help you, you know? We will help you with your music. Mm-hmm. We will give you tools to do promotion. We will give you tools to do accounting. We will give you tools to help send your feedback to the stores and do all sorts, you know. We'll have these direct connections with the EDM stores. It's designed for Beatport initially. Mm-hmm. So, and we're not just some anonymous black box, yeah, right? Yeah. We're actually there to help you.
Yep.
And we cost a fraction of what these distributors were charging. It was a no-brainer for so many labels. And it really made me incredibly proud that labels that I respected came to Label Engine.
Incredible.
Right? Like Nightbase, right? AC Slater's label. Incredible, you know? Using my stuff. I don't mean to boast, this is going to sound really bad.
No,
but
please do.
Music is being distributed through Label Engine, which is insane. Yeah. Insane.
What record?
His new track, his new single.
Newest one that just came out. Wow.
Yeah.
How did you handle when it, like, obviously you rolled it out on a very beta-ish level and then suddenly it's snowballing. How did you handle, like, when did you realize, oh, this is taking off? And how did you handle managing that?
I made a decision to sell it. Mm-hmm. Because we can now talk about the end of my career. One day, Electro House music just kind of stopped. Gigs dried up and I just knew that it was the end. At the same time, my daughter was born. So I knew it was going to be a change of pace and I wanted a stable income. I didn't want to go back to struggling. You know, I remembered what the struggle was like.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't ready to do that again. I didn't want to be one of these, you know, you see these producers that were big. And now they're trying anything. I did try a few different genres. I struggled with my sound, what it should be. No one wanted the Lazy Rich sound anymore. And I thought, might be time for a change of pace. I would rather end my career on a high note than, you know, be this struggling DJ who's ignoring his daughter because he has to work 24 hours a day trying to discover the new big sound.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's admirable.
Mm.
And to be able to look inwards and that's huge. I don't know how many people even have that concept. So
it's tough and boy, do I miss it.
Yeah.
You know, boy, do I miss the... I don't necessarily miss making the music so much, but the gigs and the touring was... I mean, like we were saying earlier, it's amazing.
Would you?
If there are any promoters in Adelaide that want a Lazy Rich comeback gig, I'll happily do a gig. Just one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Would you want to have a bash with us?
Only if M for Sonic is playing.
I'm there. You're headlining.
Well, whose name comes first?
You. 100% you. Oh, mate. I'll warm up. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, we'll set the scene. We'll, and you throw down.
But I don't think, I mean, even at my height, I don't think I could fill a room with 50 people in
okay,
in
so
LA.
If I really want to go to Japan, why would we just go somewhere else and throw down? Would you be keen? Just trip away for a weekend? Go to Japan?
Sure, if just you can. Yeah.
All right. Anyone watching?
Yeah.
If you're a promoter or a club venue or a festival owner, you've heard it here. Lazy Rich comeback.
Yeah. We'll do it for bed and board.
Yeah. No. just get us there. Get us on there. And we need a car. No cockroaches. And if you've got a computer that's post-80s that works, we're down to collaborate. Yeah. But honestly, would you? If there was an opportunity to get up and just and spin and have some fun?
For a one-off?
Yeah.
For a one-off, yeah.
I think we should
I couldn't do it to just say, oh, I'm going to stop my label engine create music group career.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go DJ again. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
It just wouldn't be fair on my family.
And I think you have almost the luxury that being in the royalty, I think you could just go, one show a year, just one and throw down.
It would be interesting. I'd say that. Right. It would be very interesting.
Global League and Friends, Luke's off camera yelling. I think this is a must because even just talking to you, like I'm feeling so motivated and smart and just like, wow, I want to sink my teeth back into the project of having that output and that feedback again. Yeah, I think we should make it happen.
Yeah. You musically dabble anymore?
I tried it because I pretty much just quit cold turkey. I just said, that's it.
You said you just deleted everything.
Deleted everything. It's all gone.
Have hard drive, archive.
No, it's just it's gone.
Was that a ritual? That's like what?
Incredible choice to make.
Why?
Why not?
To
because I mean,
amazing.
You make a decision. You either stand by your decision or you don't.
You just owned it. That chapter of my life's done.
Because otherwise there would always be that temptation. Oh, I'll knock up that old project. And I'll go and I'm the kind of person, you know, I could lose myself in a room of my own thoughts, mucking about for hours and hours and hours. You know, I remember being in the studio for like 20 hours at a time, just doing it, yep. You know, and I can't go back to that for my own mental health, you know.
What do you do now for you?
What was the last question?
Like, that was a good question.
I was saying, do you play music anymore?
I did try. I did set up like with my laptop with a little keyboard, but trying to be creative when you've only got 3 hours before lunch or before your next meeting, you can't do it.
Yeah.
It's a decision, right? You either say, I'm an artist and I'm all in and it's my life, or you don't do anything. Trying to squeeze being an artist into a couple of hours when you have spare time, it doesn't work. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I understand that acutely. We both
hard
understand
truth
that acutely.
To hear, really.
Yeah.
I've had times in my life where I've had all the time in the world, and that's when I felt the most comfortable to do anything creatively. Mm. Now currently I'm an adult and I've grown up a lot in the last few years and I don't have a ton of time. And I get those windows. I had an hour and a half before this happened. And what did I achieve? Not really a lot, but I'm trying to stay into it. But I really You're very right. It's a very much an all in, or it's hard to be half.
Yeah,
exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
So that's my thing. If I couldn't be all in, I didn't want to be in at all.
You're an all or nothing like me.
All or nothing.
Was it difficult hitting delete on everything?
No, I'd made my choice, and that was it. I knew that I couldn't go back to it.
Wow.
I as a father. I've made my choice.
And that's very strong.
Oh, it's so admirable. That's unreal. Well done.
I did like Nick's question before. So when you need to you know, have some you time, what do you get up to?
With my kids, mm-hmm. first off. I have a sports car.
Yeah.
That I take to the bend in Marla.
Nice.
I love doing that. We have the Toyota 86 and BRZ club. And we do like go to the hills and have drives and meetups every now and then. But going to the track, pushing the car around, is that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool. Because it seems so important to have just that thing that's your time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
And that's now one of the things I pour my attention into when my car isn't broken. I broke the gearbox.
It's good. Just, you're pushing it hard.
Just yanking it too hard.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you're not just, you know, gently going around corners and whatever.
No, I'm all or nothing.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
And in some of my research before tonight, I was looking at an old Reddit AMA that you did from about 9 years ago. And two questions. At the time, you said you're a big fan of the Food Network. Are you still consuming food-related content?
No.
What happened?
Food Network is fantastic couples TV because it's completely inoffensive.
Yeah.
Right? There's no opportunity to really feel strongly about anything. It's just content that you can just watch very passively.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We did used to watch a lot of Food Network, and now we have children and we have to do things with kids.
Yeah.
And also sleep is just so rare.
Sleep is rare.
You take any time.
I've really, over the last few years, I've really been fulfilling my potential as a miserable old git.
Just nailing it.
I've been getting old for a couple of years now and I don't recommend it. It's rubbish being old.
But, looking into my future.
Yeah. Hate to break it to you, but yeah. 40 hit me hard. You know? My Saturday night now, I go to bed early, but I can get up early the next day. Mow the lawn.
I mow the lawn on a Friday afternoon.
You mow
work.
The lawn on a Sunday?
Sunday morning.
You're that guy?
Dad moves.
That's rough. I'm the hungover person being like, who is that asshole mowing so early in the morning? Oh, I love that.
It's a real trip, you know, nice. Like to think back on the career that I had and the craziness.
Yeah.
Absolute insanity. Now I'm
alone.
You
did it. You did it.
I've got it. Nothing can take it away from me.
Lawn pride is a real thing. You can't be ashamed of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to take pride in it.
It's meditation.
It is.
You know, it's relaxing.
You like earmuffs on?
No, I've got electric.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's a future.
Yeah.
I've got a plug-in one. It's very frustrating.
Oh, that's nasty.
Yeah. We've got a townhouse.
That sounds dangerous. Yeah. I'd be the guy that
ran over it before. So that was a quick trip to Bunnings with half a lawn. The other half not.
The other thing I want to talk about was health.
Yeah.
As I said, I do 16 hours in the studio and I wouldn't move.
Yeah.
People often ask me why I was called Lazy Rich. And now I'm starting to realize it's because I never did any exercise, you know? And I hope that some of the people that are watching this will know how skinny I was.
Right.
Because I was dangerously skinny. I was dead mouse skinny.
Wow.
You know? And I hope that people can see that I've now had time to concentrate on myself and I'm going to the gym and I'm being healthy and I'm eating healthy. Nice. All the things you have to do when you turn 40. And it's really hard work.
Yeah.
But it's worth it.
But there's a discipline.
As you are testament to. Look at this. Look at this man.
Bursting out of his shirt.
We got to get... I feel bad. I was going to wear a black shirt, but my cat wrecked it. There's cat hair all over it. So I just grabbed one of the merch tees.
So would you say you're feeling like the best shape you've been in?
Best shape I've been in.
And how's that going for mental health?
Huge.
Yeah.
I looking back, I was just running on pure anxiety for 15, 20 years of just nonstop career.
Yep.
Always gotta, what can I do to be better? How can I be best? How can I make this track perfect? Just thinking about work all the time, like a mad professor.
Yeah.
A mad scientist, you know? And it really took a lot to kind of, you know, you're on this track for like 20 years of just work.
Yep.
And to suddenly stop that and be like, I've got to be a dad now.
Mm.
And I've got to look after myself because my back is hurting because I've sat in the studio for too long and not done any exercise.
Yeah.
And my ears hurt because I didn't wear earplugs. And all the things. You've probably got carpal tunnel from all the launch pad, don't you?
can't move this. Yeah, that's why I haven't done any videos in a while. I can't move this hand as well as the other now. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe not yet.
Well, actually, I am losing dexterity. And
are you actually seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
Massively. And I've just recently pulled my back because I'm really trying to get into the gym because it's cathartic to take anger out on weights and yeah, mm-hmm. not thoughts. And yeah, just lose too much. And now everything hurts. But I'm trying, I'm on this self-improvement that I've talked about it in other episodes. I call it stale blood and it's not a medical term at all. But I found that working in the room next door, which is very isolated and no vitamin D, no fresh air, not getting the heart rate up and doing that for years has been at the detriment of my health. And then trying to find external validation, which I wasn't getting in pretty well any aspect of my life, that can cause a lot of conflict upstairs in the brain. And becoming a father, wow, does that reset your values? And it's been incredible. But I've got dependents. I've got two kids now. I've got another one since I last saw you. And yeah, my priorities are not solely on me. However, I need to be the best version of myself to be the best to them. And that's going to have a profound effect in everything, business, music, how the studio operates, the label, everything. So yeah, I've had to grow up a lot. Yeah. Massively. So kudos to you. I toyed with the idea of writing a date on a piece of paper in a sealed envelope with, I will close the M4Sonic project down on this date, regardless of how famous it gets or whether I'm about to close Tomorrowland, which is the dream. And it's like, nope, actually, sorry, I quit the week before. Like I've written it down. I've toyed with this idea because I think somehow I've taken a little bit for granted when things were good. And not realized how hard it is to maintain. Like once you get to a certain level, and I'm sure you've lived this, there's a maintenance cycle. It's not just getting there, it's actually maintaining it. And then how do you build from that? What's the next stage? And yeah, when you lose momentum, I'm at a pivotal point right now where I'm dangerously comfortably uncomfortable. And I'm not sure the next step. So this podcast has been a massive one. It's keep skinning the game, keep making content, keep collaborating in a different realm with other people that have lived it or are aspiring to live in it. And it's been hugely motivating, but who knows what the next 10 years looks like.
Is this podcast just basically going to become self-help for failed producers?
I think I just got called out.
An avenue in that, I
just got called out.
Yeah. Myself included.
No.
Yeah, just not vent sessions with
vent
a therapist.
Sessions. Yeah. Interesting. Like, because who decides on the point of failure?
There's no failure.
Nice.
Because there's no, what does it mean? It's the only thing that matters is that you wake up in the morning and go to bed at night and in between you do something that makes you happy.
Sure.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so success is whatever you define success as.
Yeah.
It's not what the world says success is.
Which
and,
is.
And likewise, failure is your opinion of failure and not the world's opinion of failure.
So do you think with your career, it was simpler because there wasn't so much public metric data that we used as the, okay, you've had a million or a billion streams, therefore you're worthy? Or what I'm trying to ask is,
I lived through Facebook pages and follower accounts and all that. People were getting gigs because they had a million followers and all that.
Yeah.
Those gigs were usually crappy, but I've lived through that. And it wasn't fun. It doesn't make it fun.
Yeah.
That whole metric thing sucks. I truly believe that I followed my passion.
Yeah.
And I made it work through ridiculous amounts of hard work. I would say I had some luck, but I also had bad luck. It is possible to do it. Now, does that mean everyone's going to be a success story? No. But it's possible to do it enough to make yourself happy, to reach your own goals, right? As long as your goals are appropriate. Would I look back on my career and say it was successful? Yes. Did I do everything that I dreamt of? No. You know, I wasn't the superstar. I wasn't main stage ultra. But I've got enough that I can look back on my career and feel accomplished and happy and feel really good about myself, which is all that matters, right?
I love that.
It's just a way to end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're going to need a part two. If you would be happy.
Pearls of wisdom, nonstop.
If you're happy to come back and we chat more about some of the topics and more to do with your career at another time, because I think that you just summarized it perfectly then. What an absolute privilege to have you join us tonight. Thank you for the music that you've made, the software that you've made. You were really pinnacle in creating a culture like the Electro House scene. Has a lot to thank you for that, and Complex Joe. It's certainly a massive inspiration for me and for you. So yeah, unreal. Thank you for being on the Forecast.
Thank you so much. Been a real pleasure, and you're looking fantastic. Really, I think I've got new goals. You know, I know what I want to be now. You know,
just wear a t-shirt.
Yeah, just get an extra small shirt, mate. It's all lots. It's all lots.
Yeah.
You're a champ. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Unreal.
All right, guys. You can keep up with us on the socials, YouTube, Instagram, Forecast Podcast. I would say follow Lazy Rich, but are you on socials anymore? He's
off. I have a Twitter account. I don't use it.
Well.
I deleted my Facebook. I kept Twitter because...
I was going to say, you deleted everything else, but you held on to Twitter.
Yeah. I'll give my MSN. Okay.
Yeah, MSN.
Don't bother with me on socials because you won't get anything.
Follow us and then we will tell the world of when you make your return.
There we go.
Comment on the YouTube and the video and maybe Lazy Rich will just be...
Yes, yeah, love that.
In the background.
Love that. All right, until next time.
Thank you for your time, mate. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.